In this seminar on birth, death, and the unborn, we've been discussing the Buddhist philosophy of change, of life as a flowing, dynamic pattern process, which is essentially immaterial because it isn't anything you can grasp. We use the word substance, we use the word solid, we use the word matter for something you can catch hold of or stand on or rely on or cling to. And the basis of the Buddhist philosophy of change is that there is nothing of the kind. There is nothing to hang on to, nothing to rely on, nothing to cling to. But when we say, you see, something matters, the word has a double meaning in that it means that it's substantial and that it's important. And so we are brought up from birth to play the game of life in a certain way. There are certain things we are told by adults who were told by their adults who were told by their adults that these things matter. And one of the fundamental things that matters is that you go on living. And so everybody is tremendously concerned with the things that matter, that they've been taught to value. And because these things actually don't matter, that is to say, because they're not substantial, but they're all a flowing pattern, as I illustrated, a flame seems to be a substantial object that's there, and it could burn you, and you can watch it for a long time. Actually, it's a stream of hot gas. And so, likewise, the human organism is a stream of energy. It's never the same for 2 seconds. Only we've been taught to watch that thing and to cherish it and value it, and it matters, damn it. And yet it's going to wear out, and yet it's going to get sick, and yet it's going to die. So everybody is involved in playing the game of life in a way that goes beyond play and becomes deadly serious. And as a result, the whole of existence is lived in a state of constant frustration, because you are trying all the time to hold together and to preserve something which in the long run can't be preserved at all. And therefore, in response to this cry of pain which everybody puts up as a result of being in this situation, of trying to hold on to things, the wisdom of the various ways of liberation, be they Hindu, Buddhist, or whatever, is saying to everybody, look now, cool it. Wake up, see what the scene is. This is the kind of thing that's going on, and you are not a captive in a trap. You're not just some mere little measly being that somehow or other was brought into an insane universe. But you are what the thing is. You are not the victim. You are the system. Only you have identified yourself with a one wave in it and have forgotten that you are one with the whole energy that's going on. But what you're doing is you have got a particular wave, that is to say, a particular accumulation of memories, of associations, of skills, of things that you've learned, and you don't want to let go of them. Because you found in that accumulation of memories, which you call yourself, an identity. So you know where you are, or think you do. But actually, you don't need to be anywhere. Where is the universe? You know, think up an answer to that one. And so the question, where is the universe, is really ultimately the same question as, where are you? So what this is saying is, look, let go. It's all right to play the game, be involved, and work out the various intrigues, problems, creative projects, and so on that life involves, that's fine. But if you get involved in it so that you're hung up, this deprives you of delight and joy in playing the game. So the point is to get people unhung up on the whole thing, which in the way we have been accustomed to translate Sanskrit and Chinese, we have been calling unattached. But unhung up is much better. It's a much clearer, this colloquial phrase, a hang-up, is a much more direct and exact translation of what the Sanskrit word klesha means than attachment or evil passion or something like that. Klesha is hang-up. It is blocking, being fixed on a particular point of view. And I was trying to show you this morning that we can take ever so many different points of view towards what's going on. No point of view is the right one. Infinitely many points of view are possible. But if you take a point of view and you insist that's the only point of view, then you're hung up on it. If, for example, you take the point of view that there are only two kinds of human beings, men and women, and either you are a man or you are a woman, that's a hang-up, because actually we vary a great deal. There are men who have much more feminine elements in them than others, and women who have much more masculine elements in them than other women, and so there is an enormous variation. But so long as you insist that black is black and white is white and that there are Republicans and Democrats and capitalists and communists and good guys and bad guys, it's a hang-up. So also between what is you and what is other than you. Well, that's the general area of what we were discussing this morning. And now I want to go further in explaining what I started out to explain, which is the basic Buddhist idea of rebirth, of our being reincarnated. I said that this was not in Buddhism the idea that one has a kind of spiritual spook or astral spook or soul which travels from one life to another. It is a much simpler idea than that. But it's so simple that it's difficult to explain. I would begin, you see, with the assumption that every person, every sentient being whatsoever, is I. I is simply the universe aware of itself at a particular place and time. That's what the word I means. William James once said, the word I is a noun of position, like this or here. And so the feeling that we call I is how everything feels on the inside. But it is always in a particular place at a particular time. And these particular places and particular times, they keep going on and on and on and on and on. Myriads of them, all over. Not only on this globe, but probably in worlds scattered throughout the whole cosmos, the I feeling arises. And you feel that you are I just as much as I feel that I am I. And your I feeling and my I feeling are essentially the same. Only we're looking from different places. But it's all one eye. Only we don't see this because we are hung up on the coming and going of I, on the particular circumstances in which every I appears. And so, just as the flame
changes its physical identity every second, every split second, every microsecond. So do you. You're a stream. And so, taking us all together, supposing you watched the human race from a very different point of view, you were watching us, you didn't know anything about human beings, never seen them before, and you were observing what's going on in this planet from some other point of culture in space and time, and you would say, well, this world is peopling, this planet peoples, just like a tree bears fruit. And year after year, the apples that come off an apple tree all look very, very much the same. And you would say, yeah, the apples come and go, but they're always the same apples coming back. It's only if you look very minutely at the apples and studied the details of coloration and formation that you would say that one apple was different from another. Now, we're all so used to each other. And we know each other so well that we see and emphasize the differences between us. But somebody who knew nothing about humanity would see the coming and going of human beings as a repetition of the same process. Just as the flame burning. We say it's a flame, but it's a repetition of the same process. It keeps on flaming. Cha, 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 cha. You see? Now, if you're going to count each cha as a distinct and separate event, then you cannot hear cha, 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 the rhythm. So because of our myopia, because our point of view is fascinated by the details and the differentiations between everything that's going on, the differentiations between people, the differentiations between generations, we are so preoccupied with that particular view of things that we're hung up on it. And we don't see that it's the same thing happening again and again and again. And that every I that comes into this world is you. Now, you don't have to have any inside information to understand that. It doesn't require any sort of esoteric, spooky knowledge, something that can't be demonstrated. It's just looking at things the way they are, standing right out in the open and facing you. All eyes are I, wherever soever scattered, because you see, this is the place, at the point called here and now, this universe knows itself on the inside. You look around you, and you see everything, as it were, presenting an exterior to you. Supposing I want to delve into another person, how am I going to do that? Well, there are many ways I can talk to them. I can get them to express their inmost thoughts and their feelings. I can make love to another person, an exchange of very fundamental sort of electrochemical union. I can take a knife and, like a surgeon, go in and analyze. But my relationship to the other is always seeing life on the outside. However much I get down to the tiniest cells that constitute your nervous system, I'm still looking at that cell from the outside. If I go down into the molecules, I go down into the atoms, I'm still regarding them from the outside. The only point at which I know the thing on the inside is where I am. Then I have inside knowledge of what everywhere else appears to be outside. So if you want to know what all this is, that's why mystics say you have to look within. So they talk about the inner life within yourself and so on. Because that's the point at which you know what it's like on the inside. And so to realize inside, there must, of course, at the same time be outside. To realize self, there must be the counterbalance of other. Because it's like black and white, it's like back and front. They're inseparable. So then, this is where we start from. That every being coming into this world is I. And they keep on coming. Doesn't matter how long the intervals are between their appearances. Supposing this planet were completely wiped out by a cobalt bomb explosion. That would be the end of this race. In just the same way as, say, a group of insects will eat their food supply up on a plant. And the whole population will perish. happens again and again. And so, in all probability, throughout this galaxy and throughout other galaxies, there are human or comparable populations that arise and go, just as we do individually. So don't get too worried about the thought that this whole human system on this planet may go away and disappear, because if you get too worried about it, it's going to happen faster than if you don't worry about it. Because of the attraction of a vertigo, the feeling of wanting to throw yourself over the precipice, even though you know it'll destroy you. But it seems perfectly reasonable to suppose, in other words, that there is a constant rhythm of what we call consciousness, being awake to life, going on and on, just as stars go on and on. If the stars are going on all over the place, if galaxies are going on all over the place, it's equally reasonable to suppose that life is going on all over the place. And although the distances from our particular point of view between these islands of life may be vast, don't forget that the distances between the molecules in your own body are equally vast on their scale. You could go down and blow up the inside of your own head so that the various elements would be hundreds of miles away from each other, and yet somehow or other they hang together. Don't be deceived, because distance, space, isn't just removal. Space isn't just nothing. This is the grand delusion, that space is somehow a thing to be ignored. When Buddhists say that the root of frustration or dukkha is avidya, avidya means ignorance, ignoring, not knowing, and this is very clearly explainable in terms of the Gestalt theory of perception. The Gestalt theory of perception is that we notice the figure and ignore the background. We notice what is a relatively small enclosed space and ignore the more dispersed. We notice what moves against what is relatively still, and what is relatively still is ignored. So likewise, when we get a constant stimulus of consciousness, we begin to ignore it and not to notice it. Consciousness tends always to notice novel things, novel changes in the environment. So everything that the most unnoticed things in life are those which are the most constant and the most regular. And because you see you lose touch with the most constant and the most regular things, you screen them out of your general thought as insignificant. They don't matter. They're not there. And the most ignored thing is space. Because space is always the background. The solids are the figures. And therefore we say simply, space is just nothing. It may be filled around this planet for a little distance with air, which is important, because you do this a while and you notice something. See, and there's some whoosh going on. But out there, space, that's nothing at all. We can't. The Michelson-Morley experiment showed there isn't even ether in it. And so we say that is nothing. But all that is saying is that that is the background to every figure. And as the figure cannot be there without the background, the solid cannot be there without the space. And so the space of the world is the one thing we've forgotten, and the one thing that is absolutely essential to there being anything at all. But because in every direction the stimulus of space is a constant, we don't notice it. Just in the same way you don't notice when you hear music on the phonograph, you don't consider the fact that all the music that you hear is a vibrating diaphragm. Whether it imitates drums, flutes, human voices, it's still a vibrating diaphragm. But that's ignored. We don't say that's not important. But it is important. because without the vibrating diaphragm, there wouldn't be any music at all. Space, then, likewise, is everywhere. But we ignore it because it's common to everything. A constant stimulation of consciousness is forgotten. So then, we must realize that what we call separate things, separate molecules, separate lives, separate planets, separate stars, separate galaxies, are joined by space. Space, in other words, is a relationship between solids. You would not be able to think about space without a relationship between solids. And so the whole theory of rebirth in Buddhism is based on intervals, not on a transmigrating soul, but upon intervals between lives. Because it's the interval that's important. Just as in the same way, when you listen to music, you hear melody simply because you hear the interval between the tones. If you couldn't hear that interval, you would not hear melody. Tone-deaf people cannot hear melody. They hear merely a succession of sounds. And they can't understand why other people enjoy this, because they haven't got the capacity to hear the interval between tones following each other in succession, or the intervals between tones played simultaneously as in a chord. Now, isn't that magical when you come to think of it? That music is created by not so much the tones as the distance, the musical or sonic space between them. But so goes for everything. It is how it is spaced that creates the significance and interest of any being whatsoever. You say, for example, the human body consists of about 95 cents worth of chemicals. But how it's arranged. Playing a violin by a great master is just scraping cat's entrails with horsehair. But how it's done. See? So the order of the way things are distributed is the magic, and that requires the spacing, how it is spaced. And so architects, they understand that space is real, because they're always, they talk about using space. People, when they first listen to architects talking, are very puzzled, because an architect will use an expression like the function of a space, and the ordinary person says, how can space have a function? How can nothing do something? When the physicist speaks of space being curved, how the devil can space be curved? How can there be properties of space, you see? It's because the average person is simply brought up to ignore space as being total non-entity. So then, it is spaces between what we'll call solids, instants, points that makes it possible for the points to have some point. After all, if everything was point, nobody would be able to make out one point from another. So there has to be interval. So likewise, then, when it comes to considering relationships between lives. Your past life or past incarnation, your future incarnation. To understand this problem, I repeat, you do not need any spookery. It is all perfectly obvious, and I'm going to demonstrate it to you by playing a game with pebbles. Now, I've scattered these pebbles at random all over the floor.
And let's consider, for the sake of argument, that each pebble is a human life. And you see the slats of the floor going across this way. They may be taken to represent each one a century in time, clock time, calendar time. And so here are human lives, all of different sizes, lengths, that is to say, different breadths, how much they traveled, how much space they occupied, scattered right across a period of time. And we are looking at them from a sort of celestial position, with a kind of eye of God, and seeing history happening scattered all over the place. Now, one of the first things that we do when we see a scattered arrangement of this kind, the first thing may be say, oh, it's just a mess. And the second thought, it seems to have some lines of continuity in it. Because especially, you see, as you can make out, very quickly you can pick out a line. You know how you do this, lying in bed in the morning and looking at a chintz curtain, or lying in hospital and looking at patterns on a ceiling. You start to pick out designs and themes. Leonardo da Vinci used to look at dirty old walls where there's moisture and damp and mold, and see in those walls all kinds of paintings that he could therefore bring out. The glorious cave paintings which are found in the south of France by most prehistoric man, they're done by what's called eidetic vision. Those people looked in the caves at the patterns on the wall, and in them they saw cattle, people, and they simply touched them up and therefore got the most vividly realistic impressions. It's called eidetic vision. So in just the same way, in looking at this scatter of pebbles on the floor, you can, with eidetic vision, pick out certain continuities. So, if, for example, we it's very easy, you see, as things are, to spot this line. It's almost a straight line. And a straight line is an abstract concept which is useful to us. See, I notice those are all lined up like that. Now, is there a line there or isn't there? How real is the line? There was no intention to make a line. These are just where the things fall, but they do so. This particular set of pebbles happens to be pretty much in a straight line. Now, the straight line is a concept. It isn't something in the actual pebbles. And yet, at the same time, I can see it that way. So then, we might argue, if each of the pebbles in that line is representing the lifetime of a human being, because they are lined up in this way, you can say that is a continuity. In other words, this one here reincarnates as this one, and then as this one, because they continue each other and form the line. We talk about a line of descent, a line of succession. Well, that's what happens. And you see that continuity in this system, just as you see the continuity of a wave moving across the water, although actually nothing is moving. The water's just going up and down. So you would see the continuity of this. So in the same way, as I explained this morning, you consider that you sitting here are the same people who came in at the door, although you're not. You've changed completely. So this, in other words, if I insist upon seeing this continuity of lives,
then I'm reincarnating.
If I realize, however, that my seeing of a line here is purely a projection, I'm not reincarnating, I'm liberated. Or we could do it in some other way. You don't have to see a straight line to make the connections. Let's imagine that these are all pebbles in a stream. And what will make connections between them are for a little fellow who's walking around, you see, and he wants to get across the stream. And so he'll put his foot on a pebble here, and what next one can he reach? He can get to that one. And then he can get to that one. Wowee, he's going to have a little problem to go on from there, see? But maybe with a jump, he can land on that. And then on that one. And whoops, with a jump, he can hit that. He hit that one. See, it all depends on the stretch. That one. That one. That one. That one. That one, you see? And because they're each within a stretch, then that's another reason for setting up a line of continuity. Being able to see a significant connection between any of the members of the group. So what you're doing here, you see, you are making sense out of a whole multitude of human lives in just exactly the same way that you make sense out of anything else. The way you make sense out of a Rorschach blot. But after all, the whole world is a Rorschach blot. Everything in it is, what we are doing is we're making sense out of wiggly processes. There is, you see human, wherever you fly across the world in a plane, and the landscape suddenly begins to look rectangular, where there are straight lines and clear triangles, or clear circles, you know human beings have been around. Where they haven't been around, the outlines of everything are wiggly, like the courses of rivers, the shapes of mountains and forests. Because human beings are always trying to straighten things out. But we ourselves are not straightened out. We are wiggles. And we're interminably wiggling. But we are trying to regulate our wiggling by setting ourselves up in houses and going along streets with traffic lights and regulations and so on. But we are wiggling. We're trying to straighten out this wiggling. But wiggling is basic. So the whole world, especially us, is a Rorschach blot. And science is the art of trying to make unanimous sense of this block. And what science does is, it isn't that there are certain fixed laws of nature which things obey. It isn't as if the wiggly events of the world are running on tram lines, and they have to do that. They don't have to. Point is that in order to make sense out of what is going on, there's no way of making sense, because sense and order are the same thing. Therefore, we invent orders and describe the way things fit them. In other words, here is the scatter of stones, but it just so happens that I scattered them over a regularly spaced floor. Each of these divides in the planking is even. And so I can classify every stone according by numbering the board which it's on. And by doing that, I'll be able to identify them, and I'll be able to talk about various regularities in the way, you see, I threw them all out like that. And there were certain dynamic principles involved, and these principles can be measured and discussed in terms of the intervals at which all the stones fell. But in fact, though, I invented the order. That order of distances between the divides and the boards is just as much a projection on the formation of the stones as considering, for example, that this group lie in a straight line. Something projected on it. So in just this way, therefore, we are projecting onto a wiggly universe an order. It's the only way to make sense out of it. And to a very certain... Because, after all, wiggles... although they are very irregular, there is regularity in them. And you can only know that there's regularity in wiggles because there's also irregularity, and vice versa. So through noticing the regularities, you begin to make out a consistency in the behavior of events. And if you dig consistency and say, great, let's do it again. You say, oh, this was fine. Oh, that wiggle was beautiful. Once more, please. Yeah. See? Then you dig regularities, and you don't want it to be irregular, because, gee, if I were living in a world where I had no idea what was going to happen next, you know, suddenly there's going to be an earthquake. Suddenly, bang, the whole thing's going to vanish. Whoop, and I don't know what's going to happen. Bang, shoot, that could be crazy. Be great, you know. But well, we don't really settle for that. We like to things to go jum ba 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 jum, as long as it doesn't get too monotonous and boring. So therefore, we're scanning all the time the field of experience for regularities. And thus build up our hang-ups. It's got to happen every day. The mail's got to be delivered every day. You've got to keep doing your work. You've got to eat regular meals. All that kind of jazz, you see? And so it keeps going because we're looking for this regularity thing. But once again, you see, the Buddhists say, do you know this thing actually is neither regular nor irregular? You can pick out what you do. Do what you want with it. It's like, here are the chips. What value do you want to put on them? What pattern do you want to see in them? Or do you want to see them in what Buddhists call their suchness? See, that's the point of the garden, the sand and rock garden at Ryoanji. You go there and you see a lovely great stretch of white sand with five rocks on it. And that's what those Zen boys made up, and boy, do they get away with murder. They set up those rocks in the garden, you see. And everybody comes around and looks at it. And I think this must be some deep meaning in this. And so there are little guidebooks that explain that what it's supposed to be. They say, well, it's supposed to be an ocean with islands in it. Other people say, oh, it's a beach with rocks on it. Other people say, oh, well, these rocks have a certain dynamic relationship and they represent kinds of Buddhist principles. And there's a guy at Daisen Inn where they have another rock and sand garden, a very funny, cute Zen monk who gives a lecture in English. He doesn't speak English, but he's memorized a particular English lecture which explains the symbolism of all the various rocks and how they work out and how eventually you get to the ocean of liberation. All this is made up out of whole cloth. Because the whole point of a Zen garden is just that it doesn't mean any more than this means. Or any more than anything else means. The mountain over here. The fact of water. The fact that coastline goes in such and such a way. And here are we all sitting around wiggling. You know? Only because I'm talking and you've attributed certain sense to my words and so on. You think that I'm communicating something. But actually, everything that we're doing is like this. Now, we are brought up to think, oh, that's too bad. If that's all it is, you see, if it's just this suchness, if it's just an arrangement that fell out like that, what's the point? Life seems meaningless and empty and without purpose and so on, but that's just because you're geared. You've been conditioned through all your thinking to feel that things aren't meaningful unless they're meaningful. When you say, well, life doesn't have any meaning, that's because you've had it drilled into you that it ought to have. So you make a meaning out of it. And if, on the other hand, nobody ever told you that life ought to have a meaning, and that it ought to make some sense, and that it ought to be going somewhere, and that you should survive, then you wouldn't expect it. You just dig it as it happens. So, really, what this is saying is, it isn't that things are meaningless, it isn't that they're meaningful. It's just that they are so happen to be spread this way. And so, there is no fixed way you should look at it. So what is called as the first principle of the Buddha's Eightfold Path, Samyak Drishti, means Samyak, perfect, Drishti, view. Suzuki once was giving a lecture about Buddhism, you know, and he said, the fourth noble truth of Buddhism is called a Noble Eightfold Path. First step of Noble Eightfold Path called Shoken, mean right view. All of Buddhism sum up in right view. Second step of Noble Eightfold Path is, I forget second step, you better look it up in the book. Anyway, right view doesn't mean right in the sense of the particular correct view one should take. It means the complete view, which is having no fixed view. So in other words, when you say, what is the correct position of the stars in the Great Dipper, the Big Dipper? Depends where you're looking from. There is no such thing as the correct position of those stars. So in the same way, what is the right interpretation of these pebbles? Depends how you want to look at it. There was a Zen master called Ikkyu. In the front of his monastery, he had a very, very gnarled, crooked pine tree. And one day he pinned a notice on it which said, I will pay 1,000 yen to anybody who can see this tree straight. So all kinds of people came around the tree and started standing on their heads and looking at it in weird ways, see if somehow they could line up the branches to see them all straight. And there was one very smart man who came and looked at this for a while, and then he went off to see another priest who was a friend of Ikkyu's. And he said, look, what is this thing Ikkyu's doing? How would you see that tree straight? Well, he said, you look straight at it. So he went back to Ikkyu and said, I claim that with 1,000 yen, all you have to do to see this tree straight is to look straight at it. And Ikkyu looked at him in a very funny way. He forked out the 1,000 yen and said, you must have been talking to my friend, the priest down the road. So now, what are we doing, you see? You've got a universe which you're living in, which is fundamentally wiggly like this. And you are an event in this wiggle, see? Only you're trying to straighten it out. You're trying to see order in it. And your doing this is itself a wiggle. After all, you may say, part of this... one or two things in here are straight, you know, and it's their nature to go that way, to be orderly things, to be straight things, or whatever other quality you want to put on it. And we are like that. We are something in this which has it in its nature to arrange it this and that way, to want to see things straight. But actually, there really isn't anything in the whole arrangement that is the right way of doing it. And there isn't anything in life, in your life, that is supposed to happen. You're not supposed to live to be 80 or to die when you're 23. It doesn't make the slightest difference. You can be one or the other. That's why they say, in the scenery of spring, there is nothing superior, nothing inferior. flowering branches grow naturally, some short, some long. So, liberation is the realization there is no way that things are supposed to be. You don't have to go on living. You are, you know, you're what there is. It's up to you to decide, see? But there's no way it has to happen. But on the other hand, if you want to feel that there is some way you would like to arrange this, I mean, we can start pushing these things around, you know, and put them in some kind of an order, that's okay too. The point being, you will be miserable to the degree that you are hung up on the notion that things should, must go a certain way. That is to say, to have a fixed view. If you have no fixed view, you remain elastic. And about this, there is always something that can't quite be said. When we say, I have no fixed view, it sounds as if I were just a non-entity, like a moron. Chinese proverb says, as a hollow room echoes all sounds, an empty mind is open to all suggestions. But there's another sense of an empty mind than that, not the moronic empty mind, but the lively empty mind. The empty mind that can either let it alone or project patterns onto it. And especially do both. So that instead of saying, what you really ought to do is to project no pattern onto the world and realize that it's all fundamentally senseless, is to say, always do both at the same time. Project the patterns, but realize at the same time there is no fixed view that you should take. This is exactly the same thing as being able to realize that there are rights and wrongs and things that should be done and should not be done, but at the same time there's another point of view from which you can see that everything that happens is right the way it is, and that human life never makes an aesthetic mistake, just as the patterns of the clouds and of the foam never make aesthetic mistakes.